Matt Johnson, alcoholic. And I'd like to thank Kevin for calling and asking me to come and speak. It's an honor. And then to go up the chain, it's nice to see his sponsor, Jason, here, and then his sponsor, Jim, here, who rode down with me and who I sponsor. So we got like a little chain going right here. And so it's always nice to have that. I've known Jen for 24 years and watched him raise a lovely girl. And she's 20 now. And it's like crazy how we are. And the other thing is to see my good friend Betty Ann there. We go back a long time, and she knew my dad, and just all a big family here. So I'm not one of those ones that is really that creative, so I kind of got a canned pitch, so I better get right into it, otherwise we'll just go off somewhere. And I come from a normal family. Both my parents were alcoholics. I was raised around the L.A. area. I was a real sickly kid. I had asthma and hay fever real bad, and I was super accident prone. You know, I was one of those ones that couldn't walk down the street that I wouldn't get bit by a dog or step in glass. Or, you know, one time I shot out in the street and got hit by a car. And you know, so it was like that kind of thing. And then when I started going to school, I found out that I'm dyslexic and ADD, or vice versa, you know, kind of stuff. So I never fit in school, and I couldn't sit still, and, you know, I mean, it was just always one, it was just a, you know, bad deal, and I was, I always sat next to me, I guess they pushed me up into the front, but I always sat next to the winners of the spelling bees and the penmanship award and the shit, you know, to be right there, and I'd look at my stuff, you know, I'm like caveman crayon, and I'd look over there, and, you know, they'd have that calligraphy and, you know, kind of writing, and I thought, oh, my God, and I'd just wad my stuff up and shove it in my desk. And basically, when he was on and the testing was going, I'd just have an asthma attack and go home, you know, and I just couldn't take it. And that's pretty much how I went through school. In the seventh grade, with the help of a friend, I wrote a pornographic essay and got expelled from school, and that kind of was kind of the changing time for me. It's like, I that happened, and then I ran away from home, and I got caught right away and taken to the chief of police of Torrance. He told me what my problem was. He said, you're gonna go through puberty, and everything's gonna start changing here. You know, you're gonna be growing hair under your arms and on your legs, and there, you know, I mean, and so, but he didn't know it was gonna be a late bloomer, and I mean, I started growing hair when it started falling out, I think. It just went that fast for me. But the other thing that they did is they took me to a psychologist at that time. They thought there was something else wrong. And the psychologist was a dream therapist. And I liked that so much, I would make up dreams for her to analyze. You know, I mean, I just loved hearing about me. And the funny thing is, it's not much change because, you know, I was either inferior or superior, you know, and I mean, I can be that way just driving, you know, from here, you know, to Santa Barbara. And, you know, so it was just, you know, it was one of those deals. But I never fit in at school. And that was one of those things that set me apart from everybody. And, you know, I was, you know, I've always been like a loner. I was always a loner. But the thing that I learned to escape is at that time was into sports. I got into sports and I just loved it. I just killed it. And of course, the older I get, the better I was, but at playing anything. But I just, you know, it was just total release for me. And whether it was football or basketball or baseball, I just, you know, got out of where I was until I don't really remember my first drink. There was always alcohol in the house. You know, I knew what a vodka gimlet tasted like at 8 years old, you know, and or martini or, you know, Rob Roy or any of that kind of stuff. And so there was always alcohol, and I always drank. But I think I had my first drunk when I was 15. And I helped put away a fifth of scotch with two other guys. And we all reacted differently. One got puking drunk over here, and the other one kind of regressed to the corner over here. And so I was holding a cold rag on one guy's head, making conversation with this guy, put them both to bed and stayed up and finished it off, staring into the fire, you know, and a fireplace. And I don't know what it was about drinking and primal things, you know what I mean? It's like I go primal when I start drinking. You know, it's like all I want to be is, I guess, Neanderthal when I start getting loaded, you know. So there's like just about two or three things, you know, there's like there's like, you know, fire and food and boobs, I think, is about the only thing that I, you know, when I get drinking is all I think about. And, you know, so, and that's, you know, and nothing changed there, I'll tell you. And, but I would, you know, so I started getting loaded at that time. I got a job on the Redondo Beach Pier, and that job started at, I got a job, I did great, I was a dishwasher. I really moved up, and they had a Christmas party, and it started at 9, and by 8:30, or about 8:45, I'd passed out sitting in the only men's room, you know, and it was a one-seater, you know, kind of stuff, and I really wasn't passed out, but I was just so drunk that I couldn't stand up, and I could hear them in there going, you know, or outside going, hey, get out of there, you know, kind of stuff, and finally somebody, I could hear them yelling, are you in there? And I said, yeah. You got to come in and get me, you know what I mean, because I just couldn't get up. And so they come and they pick the lock and they took me, you know, they pulled me out of there and took me home to my mother who I was living with. And my folks were divorced. And my mother picked up the phone and called my dad and said, come and pick up your son. He's like you and just like you. And was the line. And my dad is a full-blooded Swede, 2-quart-a-day vodka drinker who we never talked when he was sober. And, you know, and when he'd start getting drunk, then he'd loosen up. He'd turn into Mr. Jazz. You know, he just wanted to play jazz and eat spaghetti and just, you know, he was like a different guy. And he lived in Hermosa Beach, about from here to the park from the sand. And so I moved in with him in the 60s down at Hermosa Beach, and it was like the heyday, right? You know, I mean, he had a converted garage we were living in. And it was just wonderful. And I learned how to surf down there. But the irony, it was in the 60s, it was easier down there to buy a kilo of pot than it was to buy a bottle of wine. And I liked wine. You know, kind of stuff. I like that Ripple Red and Spinata and that stuff, right? So, you know, I had to stake out the liquor store and look for somebody that looked like Billy to come by, and and I tell him I want a bottle of Ripple Red. You know, they had the 67-cent big bottles, you know, liters, and then they had the 32-cent pints. You know, and I said, I want to, you know, here's 60. I'd give them 75 cents. You know, it's like, I want a big one. But it had to be Ripple Red, not Pagan Pink, because I'd had a bad experience with some Pagan Pink and some barbecued potato chips one time where, you know, where you kind of just slurry the, you know, it's like, and, you know, the liter of that stuff goes pretty far. And so, but I would do that. But if I, you know, but on the other hand, I could call my boy Barry. And I could have a kilo of pot, you know. And at that time, they were going for about, you know, $1.25, and you know, delivered damn near. You know, I mean, it was so much easier. But at that time, you know, like I said, I was in school. I never learned how to read, you know, or write, and I had no opinions really. And I got everything from secondhand, you know, information. You know, hung out with guys like Jim who were smart and had opinions, and you know, so I kind of, if I liked it, I'd pick up their opinion, you know, kind of stuff. It's like, yeah, well, you know what Jim says, you know, that kind of stuff. And but I got most of my mantras from songs, and you know, they had all those great songs back at that time. You know, we had the Stones and Jethro Tull. You know, we used to always say, there's rock and roll, and then there's Jethro Tull, and you know, so there was great stuff coming out of there. But the song that I really liked was a song by Little Feet, but Hoyt Axton sung it, and that was, "Give me weed, whites, and wine, and show me a sign, and I'll be willing." And that was my mantra through the 60s and in the 70s. And I liked, you know, I mean, and that was the deal. I liked amphetamines for the motivation. You know, I liked that. I'd take that amphetamines and... And, you know, the whole line is, you know, and it was not that my eyes were bugging out, but my face was being pulled back like that, you know, or, you know, we were like that. And, you know, and then I would drink that Ripple just to kind of loosen my jaws and give me a little spit. And then I smoked pot to appreciate the arts, right? You know, where, you know, you could just listen to a song over and over and over again. I think, God, that was so good, you know, kind of stuff. Let's play that again. You know, and, you know, in a Gata da Vida, baby, you know, and whatever, you know, whatever it was at the time. And I just, And that's all I ever wanted to do. I mean, when I would find the right combination, it was just, you know, everything would go good. And then, you know, and I'd pepper it with anything else that was out at the time, you know, kind of stuff. And, you know, we'd get little orange barrels or little paper dot stuff, and we'd throw a little that in, or, you know, or those big gallons of Red Mountain, and we'd throw that in. And but generally, it was just a bunch of Mexican beeweed that we were smoking. That was all. It was like at that time. And every once in a while, you get maybe a little Acapulco, you know, kind of stuff. So, you know, I mean, it was just this whole variety and over again. And then, you know, and I'll tell you, like I said, I'd have been happy doing that and surfing. Surfing was great at that time, too. It was like I started surfing when it was just longboards. I went from right around 68, 69, they came out with the Clark foam, came out with the 8-foot blanks, and then they came in with all these great little small boards. And, you know, so it was like a real transition in surfing. And that was fun. I was in the middle of it, but couldn't have cared less. But I was totally in the middle of it. Just staying loaded and dealing dope out of my dad. We lived in a garage, but we had a garage, and I was just dealing dope out of there. And then around this time, my mother moved in with us, and she was your basic two scotch on the rocks with a little club soda, and then she would black out and turn into Linda Blair, you know, where she'd take those drinks, and then she'd go, and then, you know, her head would twist around. And she was the violent, profane one, you know. She was, like, throwing shit all around. And we had a door over here, you know, out in the backyard. And she'd be breaking stuff and throwing. It was like, oh, why do we have that here, you know, or that lamp. And it was just, and then she'd kind of tidy up, throw it all out in the backyard, you know. I mean, it was, or my dad would, and, you know, kind of stuff, so we wouldn't cut our feet. And that was kind of the stuff that was going on. So, I mean, every night it was one of those things where my dad would be drinking his two quarts and my mother would be drinking her two drinks, and then she would black out, go crazy, and I would just, basically what I'd do is I'd disable my father's car, go around, drive around in my mother's car, and just drink medicinally, and then I'd sleep in my mother's car. And then she'd get up at 5 in the morning out of her blackout, and go to work. She'd pull the door open, my head would fall off the armrest, and I'd come in and get a couple more hours of sleep, and then my dad would take me to school. And that's how I went through my junior, senior years. And I graduated high school in 69. Like I said, I was a functioning illiterate, and I thought I'd fooled the Torrance School District, you know, for not learning how to read. I never read a book, you know, kind of like I used to, you know, was bragging about it. And they go, this year? And I go, no, ever. I never read a book, you know, and I never realized, and it's the story of my life, is I never realized that I was going to be the one to pay the tab for everything that I did. You know, it's like I always paid the tab. And but, you know, I went off to dealing dope and all that kind of stuff. And then my mother was also suicidal. She tried to commit suicide, and they took her to that site. When she came out of it, they took her to that psychologist that I'd seen 8 years earlier, and the psychologist recommended a doctor who recommended AA, and they started going in the summer of 69. And they didn't get sober to the end, though, of 69, but they did get sober, and it changed everything, basically, around the house. They both stayed sober until they died. My dad had about 30 years, and my mom had about 18, And you know what? And so it changed the whole dynamics of the house, but it didn't change what I was doing. I was dealing dope out of the garage and drinking and doing the deal, and couldn't see anything else but that as a solution, because it was still the same guy inside. And you know, it was just like, and you know, it's like it's one of those deals when you're as a dyslexic. It didn't matter that I was 6'1", 170 pounds, in shape, long hair. I still knew that you knew that I was, you know, how dumb I was. I lived with that, you know, that voice in my head, you know, that was saying, you know, you don't fit in here, you don't belong, you're stupid, they're going to find out how dumb you are, you know, and all that kind of stuff, and I lived with that all the time. And the only time that I didn't have that was when I was really drunk or I didn't feel like I was less than always, you know, kind of stuff. And so I just, you know, I stayed drunk, but, you know, and basically, by the time I was 21, is it time yet? By the time I was 21, you know, I was getting arrested, crashing cars, blacking out, and suicidal. And my dad asked me one night. He goes, "You want to go to a meeting?" And I went to the Tuesday night Ohio Street meeting in West LA. And I went to this meeting with him, and I met a man there named Art Cole who changed my life. And, you know, he had all the great one-liners. He said, "If you change your actions, your attitude will change." And I went, and that's what I did. That's exactly, I went, wow. I thought that made sense, you know, because I'd always been lectured about what a bad attitude. Why don't you change your attitude? And if you only, you know, if your attitude was better, and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I always thought, I'd like to, but I don't know how. You know, I mean, I didn't get the code book here. You know, I mean, I never figured it out. And I'm not one of those intuitive guys that just kind of gets it. You know, I mean, I know how to be a loser, but I never really figured out how to, you know, I know how to intuitively, you know, stake out a room, or, you know, or look at a car. You know, it's like glance into a car and realize, did you see all those 8-track tapes they have in there? You know, back in those days, I had the greatest experience Thursday night. I went to the Who concert at the Santa Barbara Bowl. It was like the most amazing thing. And the funny thing about that is, now I've been sober for a long time, and it seems like at least I could have done is have a hash brownie or something when I was there, just, you know, for the Who, right? You know, I mean, that was the one thing. I never get more melancholy than when I'm in one of those deals and I think, you know, I can be around cocktail parties and, you know, and they're no big deal and whatever. I don't hear the, you know, the tinkle of the glass or the sweat going down the side of the, you know, the glass or anything. But when I was at a Crosby, Stills, and Nash or a Who concert, it's like, damn it, he passed me that thing, you know, I mean, because you can just smell it going. But it was one of the, you know, it was just, the, you know, it was just a great thing. And, you know, so, but, sorry, I digress there a little, no, hash brownie thing, I don't know. But, so, but I don't even know where I was. Art one-liner, Art, yeah, so. Art, you know, so Art just started giving me these one-liners, and he said, he goes, "Give me a call in the morning, and I'll give you an action to take." And I went, okay, and I called him, and he gave me an action to take, and I don't remember what it was, and I hadn't really gotten sober at that point, but, you know, I mean, but I started calling him, and he would tell me stuff, and it would make sense to me, and so I kept calling him. I didn't get sober right away, and I still had those, you know, finally. I was still getting drunk, and, you know, intuitively too. The one thing, another intuitive thing that I had was, I learned that when you got so drunk that if you just did this, you could get home, you know, kind of stuff, and drove with one eye, or the one that I liked the most is when I would open the door and stare at the line, and I knew I could. I would go slow enough, you know, kind of stuff. I'd be okay, and you know, so that's kind of how the way I'd gotten to that point, and. So I, you know, I had one of those ones where I'd gotten, you know, drunk, passed out, didn't mean to type of deals at the, you know, at the Ore House in Santa Monica, you know, where the great thing about the Ore House is that you would have those 50-cent pitcher nights, you know, where you'd order a pitcher and a glass was optional and you'd drink out of that pitcher, you know, and look for her, right? And then, but the problem is with that little lip, you know, when you got towards the bottom, that thing would hit that lip and then splash down the front end and think, oh man, just give me another pitcher, you know, kind of stuff. And I, you know, kind of stuff. And then I'd drive, like I said, somebody left their glasses here. So that's the kind of stuff I was doing. So I called up Art and I said, around that time too, you guys probably all remember the drought of 72 when they started spraying everything with Paraquat. And so at that time, I'd kind of just, you know, I'd put down on pot. And then because I was taking so many, like I said, amphetamines and stuff like that, you know, stimulants, that I was always seeing things scurry behind me. You know, it was like, what is that, you know, kind of stuff. So I put down on that, and I had just been drinking exclusively at the, you know, at the Ore House and the Blue Lagoon Saloon, you know, kind of stuff. So like I said, so it wasn't hard when Art said, you know, can you think you can go without drink? I called him up. And I said, I think I am an alcoholic, or I think I do have a problem. And he said, then I want you to go to a meeting. And he said, I want you to be considerate of the alcoholics and don't drink or take any drugs. You think you can do that? And I said, yeah, I think I can. And he said, then when you go to the meeting, I want you to go up to three new people you don't know and stick out your hand and say, hi, my name is Matt. What is your name? And then make small talk. And I said, you know, that's great art, but I'd reduce my small talk down to, have you scored anything lately? And I'm hungry. And he said, I'll tell you what. He goes, I'm going to give you the key to conversation. He goes, what you do is you go up to an old timer and you ask them a question about themselves. If they're any good, they'll give you 15 minutes. And that happened today. I came in and said hi to Jason. And it's like, well, then we're out here and I'm seeing him. You know, it's like, you got to, and the trick is you stay sober long enough to learn how to get away from them, you know, kind of stuff. And so I did that, and I stayed sober. You know, I stayed sober and for 38 days, and I was up in the front. You know, at the end of the meeting, I'd have a row of chairs put away before the old timers had adjusted their belts. You know how we like to stand up and go, yeah, you know, that kind of stuff. And I was just totally into it. At 38 days, I realized, I'm 21. What am I doing here? You know, it's like, what am I doing in AA at 21? And, you know, it seemed like everybody was fat, bald, and wore glasses. You know, this tie doesn't make me look fat, does it? So I thought, get me out of here. So, I called my buddy, and I met him, and he had this new stuff that had come out called a tie stick. He had or a bud, basically. So he had a bud, and then in a six pack of a bud. So we had a bud in one hand and a bud in the other. And next thing you know, that was Friday night, and the next thing it was Sunday, and I was stuck to a Naga High chair. And I thought, how did this? You know, I mean, this wasn't what I had planned. You know, I thought, you know, when I go back out, I realize that everything is going to be different, and I'm just going to party and have a good time, and nothing, you know, it's like, I just went into the same old thing. And I called up Art, I said, hey, do you think I can come back to AA? And he said, yeah, you can. He goes, that was May 27th, 1973, and I haven't had anything since. I came back, I just celebrated, well, May, I celebrated 43 years. Thank you. I'm pretty much of a freak now, and it's like, I just turned 65, and it's like I don't even know how it, you know, when I got into AA. I got into AA, and they throw that kit of spiritual tools at your feet, right? You know, and I just like, get that out of here. I kicked that out of the way right away. I thought, I'm not doing all the spirituals. You know, I'm not doing all that stuff. I wasn't going to commit to anything. I didn't think the promises had any. You know, it's like I'm 21 years old. I served. I didn't even think I had any character defects because I still served. You know, and there was nothing. I sensed the hope in the room. You know, there were so many people. There were so many great people. Betty Anuomo. And that were in the Pacific Group at that time, they were just great. There was great people, men and women, and I thought, this place just, you know, and it just seemed so genuine, and there seemed to be hope in the room, and there just seemed to be something. But the whole AA thing bugged me. I didn't really want to do anything like that. But a lot of it had to do with the fact that I couldn't read. You know, kind of stuff. And Art wasn't one of those guys who was like big on sitting down with you and reading. He would just say, hey, you know, do that, now do your fourth, and here's a list of questions, just answer these questions, and that's your fourth. So I did that to the best of my ability and stuff like that. But I stayed sober for about 7 months, and then a buddy of mine asked me if I wanted to go to Reno and take a few pounds, and we took 10 kilos there. And got rid of all but 5 pounds the first night, and we got pulled over by the Reno police. And yes, and I'm seeing headlines in my head. You know, sober member gets 20 years for drug bust. You know, it's like, you know, I'm you know, kind of thing. And the guy brought our license back and handed it to us and said, "Have a good time in Reno." And I came back and got active in AA. I can tell you. You know, I went through that closet. That, where's that kit? Where is that? You know, it's like, pull that thing out. I'll try it. Okay, I'll try it. And basically, I committed at that time. I committed to AA and got involved and followed directions. And I was really blessed at that time to kind of, you know, it was sort of the golden age of AA in the West LA area. There was just nothing but great speakers. There was a great speaker named Norm Alpe. If you ever get a chance to get the tape, wonderful speaker. He could give a 2-hour talk in 40 minutes. You know, kind of stuff. And, you know, with a lot of a, yeah, he would, you know, he bought the package, you know, kind of stuff. And he just had great, you know, voice, you know, inflections. And it was just, he was a terrific guy. But he had some super lines. And one of his lines was, if you hear a line you like, steal it. Give the guy credit 3 times and then it's yours. And I mean, and that's really the story of AA, isn't it? I mean, we got the first 164 pages, which is the black print that doesn't really change. But everything we learn in here, there's a lot of original ideas, but mixed with a lot of great thievery, and I think, you know, kind of stuff. So, but Norm's line, you know, he had those kind of lines, and you know. He had a great, I don't know, and I don't even know what a smiling Frankie Gordon suit is, but he always said, yeah, I used to, you know, I'd have 50 cents worth of chili, you know, on the front of my smiling Frankie Gordon suit, you know, and, you know, kind of stuff. So I just, you know, that kind of stuff. And then the other thing that I always liked from Norm was this, he'd say, you know, he ran the Midnight Auto Supply out of the San Gabriel Valley. And he'd say, but if he found something he liked that was too big to steal, he would just lay down next to it and claim it, and you know, kind of stuff. And I don't know why I always remember that, but you know, but he was just a funny guy. But we had, you know, it was always those kind of speakers going on and that kind of stuff. And I was at a meeting. I started going to more meetings regularly, but I, you know, like I would sit in the back and just steal lines and take inventories, and that was pretty much what I did. And I went to this meeting at 26 and Broadway, and you could sneak in the back door and get a cup of coffee while the meeting was going on and not really go to the meeting. And so I snuck in the back door, and I was coming out, and on the porch was this guy named Cecil, and he had another guy named Cecil with him. And it was like a funny thing. It's like two Cecils at one time on this porch, you know, and the one Cecil was pretty active. The other Cecil had an overcoat on, and his pockets were filled with leaves. And he was just going to try AA, and if it didn't work, he was going to walk to Oregon and just eat leaves to get by, you know. So, you know, I thought, bingo. And so I told Cecil, I said, listen, I'm going to go to the Thursday night 4th and Wilshire meeting, and, you know, if you want to meet me there, I'll introduce you around. And back in those days, it was like, and there's a lot of young people there, you know, kind of stuff. And so he met me there. And I took him around this room, and I introduced him. And when I sat down, when the meeting started, I had the epiphany. I realized that I knew almost everybody in that room, and I felt good about myself. And it was like that turning point where you go from being a taker to a giver, you know, kind of stuff. You get feelings from doing something for somebody else, as opposed to always trying to grab enough for yourself. And that was was the big deal for me. And it really worked out. It was really nice. And Cecil now, he's been sober for 42 years and kind of stuff. And, you know, we just had a great relationship over all these years. And, you know, we're always been, you know, on and off together all the whole time. He lives in Pasadena or Burbank now. But that was the kind of thing that happened. I learned how to read in AA. I learned how to read Tarzan books and cowboy novels. And so I would sit in these meetings and try to figure out if I could swing out of here. Let's see, could I swing out of, the other thing, when you're stealing lines and taking inventories and then you lean back and you just stare out, you know, it's like trying to get through the meeting, you know, and I would think, God, maybe I could go from chandelier to chandelier or, you know, or whatever. And I would just sit in there and think that. But I learned how to read, and I learned how to read well enough to read the sports page and the big book and, you know, kind of stuff. So, it still took a long time, and it still always bugged me, but not enough for me to go ahead and do any higher education. Don't get me wrong, I, you know, paced myself on that one, but which is also the story of my life, you know, kind of stuff. But I did that, but the thing that I learned in the Pacific Group was that it's all about action. Action is the magic word. And it didn't matter that I wasn't great at reading. I could put away chairs like nobody. You know, I could set up tables. I could, I could get there early and set up, and I could stay late and mop and, you know, and clean ashtrays. And I did that kind of stuff. And I got on the, you know, the kind of the AA invisible conveyor belt, you know, of action. You know, I mean, I, you know, and in our group, we were all real time conscious. And so you would, we would help move even and stuff like that. And then you would eat by sobriety at the end, you know, kind of stuff. And so I knew I was, I got in right behind Shirley Fraze and right in front of Mike, you know. And so we, you know, I knew where I was, but I got into action. And that was the easiest thing because, like I was saying, because I, you know, being just, you know, ADD, I'm always moving. You know, kind of stuff. And I could do that stuff. And I did it. And I stayed sober. And then the other thing that we did is we played a lot of sober softball back in those days. And that was like, you know, I played ball. And it was what I looked forward to. And because of that, I gained a bunch of friends in, you know, kind of stuff. So, but really, you know, that really kept me going. And then I just, like I said, I was lucky. We had to have a shirt and a tie from the time I got sober, because we, and the other thing that we did is we did panels everywhere. Whether we would go out to Tehachapi, we'd go to, before it became Hotel California, when it was still, you know, Camarillo State Hospital. And, you know, we had a panel into there. We had a panel at the Midnight Mission. We had a panel down in Norwalk. We were going on traveling panels where you drive to Bakersfield, you speak at Bakersfield, and then you go to, and spend the night, and then we'd go to Fresno, and then we'd drive around and come back, and then sometimes we'd go all the way to Monterey and speak there and play softball, and then, you know, but it was all 5-minute pitches, but you had to have a shirt and tie, and you had to look nice and be an example of AA, and, or, you know, or Clancy's example of AA, right, you know, kind of stuff, so, you know, but we did that, and it, you know, it's funny, it ingrained in me that, and, you know, I always, you know, I did the deal, and I always felt great because of it. I always, you know, it's always one of these things where it's always excited to be asked to do this kind of stuff, but I've always been a reluctant participant in my own sobriety. You know, it's kind of like, I'll say yes, but then when it gets here, I think, Christ, I wanted to watch reruns of, you know, Law and Order today, you know, kind of stuff. And but then on the way home, it's like, I feel so much better, you know, kind of stuff. And I think that's really the bottom line is, I guess it doesn't matter necessarily the intentions. It just, you know, it's the actions. And so I've always had, you know, I've always had shitty intentions, but I've always taken the right action. And it's because it was ingrained in me. And I try to do the same with the guys that I sponsor and they, you know, kind of stuff. So, but the one thing, you know, so that's basically, you know, I was in this group, and I saw her, even though she was married, and had to have her, and she separated, and I pounced, and it had more red flags than you could shake a whatever at, and I painted them all green and married her, right? And it was great. You know, it lasted 13 years, and I only had to play child support for another 15, you know, after that, basically, and stuff, so, and, you know, I'd have done anything for her, but she did give me 2 great kids, and, you know, and I loved her for that, but, I got divorced. She actually left. She was in Al-Anon, and then we moved up to Santa Barbara, and she kind of just dropped out, and it was kind of interesting to watch, even on the Al-Anon side, where the absence of spirituality just go, and then she was completely out of it, and then she didn't want anything to do with it, and she was saying, you know, I don't know why we can't just go over to Tony and Mary's, get in the hot tub and smoke a joint and drink a beer, you know, kind of stuff. And I for a minute I was thinking about that, you know, kind of stuff, and then I kind of played it out, and I was thinking, yeah, then I start groping Mary, and Tony gets all pissed off, and he's got a ponytail, and I'd have to grab him by the ponytail and just beat him to death. And I thought, you know what, that isn't a great idea. Why don't you go ahead, you know, kind of stuff. And so she left, and then I got all bitter. I was all pissed off. I was 20 years sober and thinking, this is, you know, I can't believe this. And you know, people were coming up to me and say, hey, don't worry, bigger and better things are in store for you, you know, kind of stuff. And I'd say, you don't understand it. You know, it's like, but what they didn't understand is what was going on in my head was I was in, you know, when I had lost control. I, you know, thought I was in control of everything. And Betty was busy in Al-Anon trying to set me up with a new Al-Anon and stuff like that. You know, her and all her girls, they were all really sweet to me at the time and, you know, kind of stuff. But I had to go through what I had to go through, and I had to realize what my part in it. You know, it's like I never realized my part in anything until that, and I really had to figure out what is my part in this. And you know, and I was a controlling bastard is basically what I was. You know, I wasn't a fun guy. Is that fun? You know, it's kind of like I was saying, it's like sports. You know, I wasn't as fun as I always thought I was. I guess around the house, that is, and you know, kind of stuff. So that didn't go well, and I bought, you know, 3-4 years into it, I finally realized, what my part was. I kind of turned everything over, and I was just, you know, kind of praying, and I did that whole, I want to just, thank you for the, you know, for what I got, and I want to be a good AA, good father. Oh, and if, by the way, you know, if you happen to see somebody who lives close and has low mileage, no puppies, that would be fantastic, you know, kind of stuff. And all of being in service. And so I was at Vince Joe's 25th birthday party, and I looked across the room, and there she was, right? And that arc fired all the way across. She came over to me. Now, I've been in automotive selling auto parts for 40 years now, but for, at that time, 20 years. Negotiating million-dollar deals, going in and with a handshake and a high five, you know, millions of dollars worth of auto parts. And but she came up and started talking to me, and I started stuttering. I couldn't think of it. I was like, she goes, "Yeah, I was in Santa Barbara. I love that area." And I was thinking, I go, "Well, if you're ever there again, call me." And she just looked at me like, "What? You know, what's wrong with you?" And so I came out of it a little bit, and I got her number, and I called her, and I said, "Hey, I'm going to be in L.A. Do you want to come?" She goes, "God, I'm all the way down here. You know, do you want to come down here?" And I go, "I love to drive." And, you know, so I started driving down there, and we really clicked. And she said, "You know, I got two kids." And I go, "I love kids." And, but I took care of the other thing, you know. So we never had any. So I'm lucky. I just celebrated our wedding anniversary. I've been married 31 years. Gross, 18 to her, and you know. So I've been, you know. So we've been married 18 years. It's been fantastic. And she's sober in AA. You know, she was a newcomer when I married her. She only had 10 years, and. But we've got, you know what, we made a pact from the very beginning. It was like AA comes first, then comes our kids, you know, and then comes us. And, you know, we made that, and we lived that, and that was the way, you know what, it worked out really well. And we just had a terrific, we've had a great marriage, you know. I mean, because we kept AA first, and, you know, she's got her girls, I got my girls. Every once in a while we go to, wait a minute, am I Donald Trump here, or what am I here? It's like. I got her, my guys, and she's got her girls, and we get together, and we do that stuff, and then, you know, we occasionally go to meetings together, but mostly I go to Thursday night men's stag. We are like men without legs in Santa Barbara, where you walk out, you know, the edge of the continent, you're staring at the Pacific Ocean, looking at the Santa Barbara Pier. It's just like amazing. And there's some other little odd stag, but don't pay any attention to those guys. They got, there's a Wednesday night stag there too. That's really great too. But the Thursday night's really the one where all the sobriety is. And but I go to that, and I go to they got, you know, those great 5:30 meetings there at the Alana Club Sundowners, and I go to those. And you know, it's like, and I got a great life today. You know, I learned how to work in AA. I learned how to work, but I had a sponsor in Clancy at one time, and, you know, I didn't want to go to, I was just going to collect unemployment, and he said, "You will go and apply at that job," you know, and I'm like, "All right." And I got that job, and it was selling VW parts, which is great for a dyslexic, right? VW. You know, everything's small there, you know, and I mean, I didn't have to think a lot, and I could just sell. And the funny thing about business is it's really similar to AA, right? guys just want to get, you know, you walk in here and, you know, it's like Kevin, you know, seeing Billy and seeing, you know, Kevin and Jason, it's like you slap them on the back and go, hey, how are you? How are the kids? You know, what are you up to? You know, that kind of stuff. And the funny thing is, going into a shop and or, you know, getting to know somebody in business is the same way. You shake their hand, you pat them on the back, you go, God, I love your shop, and how's your kids doing, and, you know, what are you doing? And, you know, it's like the things that I didn't know in life all unfolded here for me in AA. Everything that I learned that I did here applied out there and stuff. There used to be a guy in the Pacific Group, his nickname was Freight Train McLean. And he was an old horse's ass, and nobody liked him. But he took a liking to me, and he would always be by me all the time. And I always remember going to Art, going, Freight Train won't leave me alone. And he said, listen, kid, the world is filled with Freight Train McLeans. He said, if you can learn to, you know, to deal with him here in AA, the rest of them out there won't ever bother you. And, you know, and I went, you know, it's like, it was always those kind of revelations. I went, okay, and I did, and I, you know, I learned to be a friend of Freight Train McLean, and now, you know, I'm sort of friends to the ones out here, you know, kind of stuff, the ones, you know, it's like, it made my life a lot easier, but it was all these life experiences that I learned in AA that I've been able to apply out there, and I've been lucky, you know, I mean, like I was saying earlier, I know how to be a loser, that's easy. The thing I learned in AA is how to be successful. And I don't mean financially. I mean spiritually. You know, I learned how to read and get into the big book. And, you know, there is nothing more rewarding than sitting down with a new guy and reading the book. And, you know, it's kind of fun to see the archives and explaining him the thread that goes from, you know, from Roland Hazard to Ebby to Bill, you know, to Henrietta Seiberling to, you know, to Bob. To, you know, all the way down, you know, and the connection between Silkworth and Sister Ignatia and, you know, and those kind of things. And then, and going through the doctor's opinion and stuff and, you know, kind of stuff. And then I love your, you know, the bookmark that is AA approved there, you know, basically for AA approved literature. But, you know, it's half a vision for you. But I love that. You know, I love a vision for you, you know, kind of stuff. And I live that. And I love the thing about in the big book where at the beginning when they talk about, you know, we don't have a monopoly over recovery. And then in a vision for you, it says, we realize we know only a little. You know, I mean, they're not it's kind of like they're not, you know, going all ego on us. You know, they're just saying, here it is. It's in the black print. Work the black print. This is what we found that has kept people sober. And, you know, and I like that. Although I like the guy we PC talks about. You know, when you look at the big book, the first 164 pages is about this big. You throw it on the floor. Most of the people will just step over it. They don't even bother with the first 100, you know. They don't even trip over it, you know, kind of stuff. And it's just the people that get into it. And, you know, like I was saying, it's, you know, there's, you know, it gets pretty, there's somebody. And it must be the time. Is that time? You know, it's one of those things where, you know, it's so simple, but it's so elusive to so many people, and it's just amazing. You know, I look at, and I know Jim and Jason and Kevin, they're into it, you know, kind of stuff. And we have a big, you know, you go to Santa Barbara and you go to these meetings, you get a guy to sponsor you, you got to be ready to do the steps, you know, kind of stuff, and not at your leisure either. You know, I mean, and when I got sober, it was kind of like at your leisure. It's like, okay, well, we're going to do the first step now, and then read the big, you know, read to, you know, up to the third step, and then we'll do that, you know. And I think I kind of, you know, I went through my first 9 steps in about 9 months or whatever, you know, somewhere around there. And now it's like, dude, let's get to it, you know, kind of stuff. And that is, I think, the, you know, the great part of that thing. And you know, I think the kind of the joke is I've, you know, I always say, I heard, you know, I've always been obsessed with everything, you know, from the beginning, whether it was, you know, drugs or alcohol or sex or, you know, Haagen-Dazs ice cream or ESPN. The only thing that I ever really learned to work to moderation was the steps, you know, kind of thing. And, you know, I thought I got to pace myself here a little and, you know, kind of stuff. But I'm telling you, it is the, you know, for me, the thing that, you know, that's made my sobriety, you know, it's kind of like what still gives me great pleasure is, like I said, is when I get to work with a new guy and be reminded why it is that I'm here. And we just had a ration of deaths up in Santa Barbara, you know, young guys that have gone out, either hung themselves or ran in the trees or, you know, OD'd in the, you know, whatever. And it's very sad. But you know what? The way I look at it is there's two things that I'm into. I'm into the miracles where you see a guy come in and he's missing his teeth and he just comes out of the oleanders pushing up. He parks his cart and he comes in. And next thing you know, he's got a new grill and he's got his welding degree and, you know, and he's out making it. And, you know, his kids give him a cake. And it's like a miracle that that happens. But then there's the other thing. It's that, you know, the overdoses and the drunk driving deaths and the stuff like that. That remind me that, you know, that the road to AA is paved with the dead bones of alcoholics. And we got to be reminded of that because, you know, you can sit around here and look at all the smiling faces here and all the nice people and that kind of stuff. And, you know, especially that table over there, not necessarily this table. But you know, when you look at that, and I'm not necessarily up in Santa Maria here, but, you know, I take it for granted that this is just an easy deal now, you know, kind of stuff, that all I have to do is, you know, stay spiritually, you know, we throw it around, as long as I stay spiritually fit, everything's going to be okay, you know, kind of stuff, and which I strive for. I try to turn it over every day, you know, and do my prayer and meditation and do all that kind of stuff, and not pray for anybody else except for maybe a winning lotto ticket occasionally and, you know, stuff like that, but, you know, I mean, it's just... But I, you know, just to be reminded that, you know, the reason why I'm here is because I should be in jail, or, you know, or I should be either crazy or in jail. My mother was I'm blessed that when I came in here is that I didn't realize that the second step was about, you know, the insanity of the first drink. I thought it was about the insanity of my mother, and I thought if I stayed sober, I wouldn't go crazy like my mother. You know, kind of stuff. And I stayed in here long enough to contract alcoholism. And now I'm blessed to have stayed here this long. And I really want to thank you all for listening. Thanks.